An aid worker's personal security is impacted by where the aid worker is, who they are, and their role and organization. Organizations have a duty of care to take all reasonable measures to protect their staff from foreseeable risks, including those that emerge due to personal characteristics. I am Tara Arthur with the Global Interagency Security Forum. Join us as we explore the interplay between inclusivity and security risk management. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, it would be great to start with a little introduction for those of you who may not have the pleasure to know you. So why don't you introduce yourself a little bit and maybe start with a little bit of who you are, role you play in your organization, and we'll dive in a little bit and more into how you came into the sector.
Okay, so my name is Lisa Riley. I am currently the Executive Director of the Global Interagency Security Forum, or GISF, a much easier mouthful. I found it very surprising to discover I've now been in this role for 10 years. The longest I'd previously held a job was 3 years. And I think it's interesting for me in terms of how exciting and fascinating that this job has proven to be, because it certainly wasn't what I was expecting to do. But I don't come in from a traditional security background, being an engineer to start with, and then getting my security experience from working overseas and being responsible for programs in the likes of Afghanistan and Mindanao in the Philippines. So it sort of took me a bit by surprise when I started learning more about, you know, security risk management and the theory behind it and the practice and the difference that it makes, and really understanding how much difference it does make, not only in terms of the work experience of the individual humanitarian aid workers, but also their ability to achieve the objectives as to why they do the work in the first place. And while you might think that, you know, keeping staff safe should be a no-brainer, it is sometimes frustrating that it is such a struggle for organizations to accept that security risk management is not about preventing programs from happening, but really about enabling staff to do the job that they want to do and to do it effectively, and being able to give their all to doing that job, because they're not worrying about, are they safe? Who's looking after them? Can they trust the organization to take care of them if something happens? Yeah, so I hopefully that gives you a bit of background about who I am and why I do this job.
That's great. And that's quite the background. And I will say that it's a pleasure for me to do this with you, because I happen to work with you. And so it's an added bonus to have this conversation and hear a little bit more about your journey into the sector. And so I think, you know, as this series is focused about inclusivity and we're talking about the intersections between inclusivity and security risk management, it would be great to hear your reflections on what inclusivity means to you. And then if you could tell us a little bit about information about your journey into the sector. So it would be great, as this series is focused on inclusivity, if you could share with us what inclusivity means to you.
Interesting question. It's a word we throw around, and how often do we stop and think about what it means? As inclusivity within what we do at GISF, I mean, that started, we did a paper a long time ago around gender and security. And I think that was really the starting point for me, and sort of trying to recognize, and I don't know really that I understood what we were doing it, but it came from the need to recognize that men and women are different, but but it doesn't mean that women are the weaker sex. And coming from an engineering background, so I did mechanical engineering, there was five women on a course of 100 men. And I continued to work in fields which were very male dominated. So I've always sort of looked at, I don't want to say I fought, because I don't feel it's been a fight, but I've always been aware of that. And when I was younger, I mean, I thrived in it. I reveled in it. I enjoyed it. But as I got older, I discovered the company of women and discovered how much I enjoy the company of women and working with women, and how much I had changed my behaviours of who I was in order to fit into the very male-dominated environment. There was a fashion for women's security training, and it still exists, but not so much within the NGO sector. And I was thinking back, you know, as a younger woman who's fighting against this perception of being the weaker sex, if I was told to go on a security course for women, I would have been livid. I don't need that. Why do I need that? And then as I learned more and actually attended a couple of these security courses for women, it was absolutely fascinating, and it provided a safe space to discuss issues that were important to women. And it's really interesting when you talk about sexual violence in a mixed group, it tends to concentrate on the really violent, the rape, that aspect of it. My experience when you talk about it in women-only groups is that it's the day-to-day harassment that makes your life just less worth living, because every day you cope with little bits of undermining who you are, or references to how you got to where you are. I know when I still did engineering in the UK, that people said behind my back the only reason that I had got to the position I was in was I must have slept with somebody, which I hadn't, by the way. But they couldn't recognize that I could have made it there purely on my abilities. So that sort of space which allows people to be who they are is, to me, what we want to achieve with inclusivity. And it's not about, I don't want to be an advocate for you've got to have a group of women talking and then you've got to have a group of people of a certain ethnicity or people of a certain colour or people of a certain sexuality. What would be fabulous is if we had a group that was completely mixed, but everybody felt able to be their whole selves and bring their whole selves. And I know in a previous recording, there was a brilliant line about, you know, diversity is about inviting people to the party. Inclusivity is inviting them to dance.
Really well said, Lisa. I think that's some really interesting points. And, you know, just building a bit more into what you've just shared about inclusivity and kind of your reflections, when you think about inclusivity and security risk management, how do you make that more practical for people? And you started to talk a bit about the idea of feeling safe. Do you have other insights into how that looks in practice?
I think in practice, it is about making sure that people feel safe, that it is, that people recognize that security practices are written for them, and that's everybody, not that they're written for the profile of the person who wrote them, whether that's a local, national, ex-military, whether it's a white woman, whether it's a white male, expat, ex-military, which is what we tend to think of as your typical security manager. It doesn't matter who wrote it. If they write it only from their own perspective, it's not going to capture the needs of everybody. Now, we're not saying that you have to write a separate security policy for everybody. That is completely impractical and nobody could do it. But do you provide the space and the time for individuals to think about who are they? And this has been one of the, my interesting learnings on this sort of journey around inclusivity, is me making the time or having the time to think more about who I am and what are the consequences when I travel of who I am. So it's not about me trying to fit somebody else's stereotypical idea of how I ought to do security, but me knowing what the threats are, what the risks are, what are my vulnerabilities in that context, and what do I need to ask for to be able to feel safe, and to have an organization who is open for me asking for what I need and doesn't sort of, you know, here you are, here's the plan, take it away, learn it, we'll test you on it tomorrow. That doesn't make me feel safe. And the other aspect that I think, which is something that is a really practical aspect that I think could make such a huge difference, is the bystander awareness. I mean, and it grew out very much, again, around the discussions, particularly around sexual violence and the need for this to be everybody's responsibility. You don't turn your back because you might embarrass yourself if you help someone else. But that awareness, and that, again, for me, that idea of team values and team support. And I remember at times, particularly as a country director when I was in the field, it's a very lonely place to be at times. And there's a couple of countries, there was this fabulous network of country directors who was a really safe space because it was somewhere you could go and moan. But nobody, because we all took it in turns, we all had bad weeks at different times. So you knew that that wasn't going to go anywhere, but that you had somewhere that was supportive. Now, if we think about security risk management is about keeping staff safe, how do you create that same supportive network within the team? Somebody has got to be the timekeeper and going, okay, guys, no, this is a really interesting conversation, but we need to be leaving now. And if you've got that team that feels comfortable and safe together, that person, whether they're the team leader or otherwise, will recognize that that's the right thing to do. And you won't have the driver sitting there getting really nervous because the team leader is sitting and still in the meeting and won't leave the meeting, and they don't have the authority or the not even the authority, the belief that they would be listened to, that they have a right to bring in their fears and concerns. I think a lovely example of this was one organization I worked for in Afghanistan, and we had very senior visitor from headquarters who'd come out to visit the team. We had a meeting, so we got in the car and we were sitting there chatting away as you do. And we look up and we haven't gone anywhere. And just sort of say to the driver, and he says, sorry, she's not wearing her seatbelt and we can't move. Now, he couldn't get a word in edgeways to stop us talking. Wow. But he wasn't going anywhere. And he felt confident enough that he could tell this extremely senior person that they weren't moving because she wasn't wearing her seatbelt.
What do you think was part of building the support in the infrastructure for that individual to have that confidence? Do you think that was something organizational that could have supported that confidence, where they felt that they wouldn't have been negatively impacted by speaking out? Or do you feel that that was a function of them as an individual?
I think a bit of both. I think in most places, most places we work, from my own experience, continue to be generally very patriarchal and very hierarchical. And we certainly see it amongst national staff, where you might have a more senior position being unable to tell colleagues who are older but junior what to do. And so I think there is this, we have to recognize that there is often this hierarchical structure. So just telling a driver, you've got a right to do this, isn't necessarily going to give them the confidence that they can do that. So there has to be an organizational attitude and perspective and behavior that maybe it was the first time he'd done it. I doubt it. But it's one that if he says it to somebody senior who goes, oh, I don't want to wear a seatbelt, then his ability to do that is diminished. And if he does it twice and it doesn't happen, and maybe he reports it and nothing happens, you're going to go, well, I don't care. I've got my seatbelt on. I'm safe. We have an accident. They're killed. So what? So there has to be an organizational belief and an organizational structure which reinforces that. And we so often see it in security risk management where, you know, there may be travel restrictions or a curfew or driving limits. And I certainly know when I visited field offices and the driver is driving, to my mind, too fast. And a lot of countries that we work in don't actually have speed limits per se. So, and I've said to the driver, do you mind slowing down? Because I think you're going too fast. And they go from the sublime to the ridiculous. So they'll go from 80 on a dirt road to 30. And I've sort of spoken with, say, junior international staff, and they've gone, oh, yeah, that guy always drives too fast. But he's so aggressive and he's so, this is my car, I'm in charge, that they don't feel empowered to actually say, I'm sorry, I don't feel safe. Do you mind slowing down for that? Or there might be a rule that you don't go to a certain area of the city, you don't go to a certain restaurant. Now, if the boss is going, I like this restaurant, I'm going anyway, why would other staff, and if they're breaking that rule, why wouldn't they break the others? So it's a very structural thing. It is, you know, you can speak all of the right stuff, but if you don't behave in a way that actually reinforces what your stated policies and practices are, then as you go down the hierarchy, they're going to have less and less belief in those structures and those systems.
So I want to take you a bit into this conversation around, you know, policies and examples and, you know, shift gears a little bit. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on where inclusivity could come into play at the start.
Yeah, the whole idea of inclusivity, it's much easier to bring it in at the beginning than try and insert it halfway through. So the starting point, a lot of discussions is around doing a risk profile of the role. Because one of the things, when you start getting into inclusivity and security, is the concern about anti-discrimination legislation and practices. And they are really important and we don't want to break them. But the problem is that those laws are often been interpreted as, in order to not discriminate, we need to treat everybody the same. Now, the problem is everybody isn't the same. So it's very difficult to treat everyone the same and meet our duty of care obligations. So what we need to do, if we start by risk profiling the role, we know the sort of risks that that particular role in that particular context, and it's very context specific, is likely to face. And there are things in there, you know, examples like the one we always use, homosexuality is illegal in Uganda. So when we started working in Erbil as international organizations, there was a lot of distrust of Arabs. And one organization had sent in an Egyptian project director, very competent, very capable, and extremely distrusted by the team that he was there to try and manage because of his ethnicity. So it's not always a case of the obvious. And, you know, often it's national ethnicities. And again, it's not saying that you should only employ this sort of person in that role, but it's making you aware of what are the consequences if you employ a certain person. And it's also about providing as much information as possible to the individual going to do the role. I mean, from a personal example, when I went to work in the Philippines, I had been in a couple of fairly high-risk countries. The post I applied for was advertised as a family posting. I didn't have children, so I didn't need the family posting, but I was going, must be a particular environment that I could take family with if I had them. And during the interview, I asked if there were any security risks. And the person interviewing me said, oh, you've worked in Afghanistan and Sudan, nothing like that here. Went through the induction just before leaving Thailand to go into my posting in the Philippines. I discovered that my predecessor had been evacuated out because of a kidnap threat. Now, nowhere had that been explained to me before I was 2 weeks into my induction at that point where I discovered it. Now, it didn't stop me going to the job because at that point I wanted the role. If I'd had a family, that organization would have employed somebody who couldn't do the job. Because there's no way I'd have taken a family into somewhere. And for those of you who know, this was Mindanao in the Philippines, which is not the safest place in the world. A lot of kidnap for ransom threats down there. So, you know, that was not fair on me as an individual going into that role. Now, if that role had been properly risk profiled and actually included in the job description as part of the, you know, the application in the first place, and then part of the recruitment discussion to give a sort of a thorough security briefing on what was there, it makes a huge difference. So it really needs to come in right from the beginning. And it's not about going, right, okay, Lisa's a white woman. I'm going to tell her about the security threats for a white woman. You know, what are the general security threats? Do you need to be aware that they treat women differently to men? Do you need to be aware that homosexuality is illegal because you don't want to be making those sort of jokes and outing somebody else who then puts them at risk? So it's again, I've heard people say that often when security officers do a security briefing in country, it's more to demonstrate how much they know than it is about actually informing the person who's coming into the country. So I think I've possibly gone a little bit off topic, but that's, to me, that's where it starts, is right at the beginning. And when we did the GISF paper on diverse profiles, we did talk to the lawyer about, can you do this? And certainly what the lawyer said to us was that, you know, if you say at the beginning of the process, these are the risks that you face, do you want to join? That's acceptable because you're giving people information to make choice. if you get halfway through the process and you're left with three people and you go, Lisa's a woman and we really don't want a woman in that posting, we won't take Lisa, we'll take the other person, that's discrimination. And that's too late. You shouldn't be doing it then. Women need to know if they're applying for this role, it's not a family posting. So it's really about, I suppose, giving people the information to make informed decisions. And that whole process of openness, transparency, accountability throughout the process. And so there's, people talk about the organisational duty of care, and the organisation does have responsibilities around taking reasonable measures to keep people safe. It doesn't mean you can behave like a complete idiot and ignore the rules and blame the organisation. So part of that informed consent process is also saying, well, these are the threats. How we mitigate them is we have an 8 p.m. curfew. And you're not allowed to go out after that point. And we can't allow you to drive because of this and this reasons. So that informed consent process, it's not only about, these are the organization's responsibilities. It's also about, what is expected of you as an individual. And again, you have that information so you can make those decisions. And the more information you have, the better your decision, the more prepared you are to go. So the better, the more effective you're going to be in your job, because you're not going to be going, what happened here? I'm not expecting that. So you can arrive ready, you understand what you're going to do, you can get on with it, and you can be effective in your job. And I think you're much more likely to stay, certainly if I think about myself. If I have all the information and I've made the decision to go there based on correct information, I'm going to be much happier there than if I'm forever struggling because I don't really know, I didn't know at the time what it was that was expected of me.
So thank you for sharing that. I think your reflections are very informative to, getting that informed consent straight from the start and giving everyone the information they need. And you've talked about it from the hiring process. And if you could just briefly make a comment or two about what happens when you're already in the organization and they decide to deploy you to another context. How does that interplay? And how can you be more inclusive in the approach to considering somebody's profile within that when they're already within the structure?
I think the idea of informed consent and that whole idea of the openness and transparency and accountability should play into, different locations. And it is interesting because a lot of headquarters staff, they're 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there. It might be that they're on longer term postings and they go and they'll do 6 months there and then they'll get a couple of weeks off and then they go. And when they leave, they're not sure, are they going to be covering it for a month? Are they going to be there for a year? But the more information people have at the beginning, the better. And one of the things, if we think about that sort of that bystander aspect and that team, what's your feedback mechanism like? Are you getting good information from the last person that visited? Or if one person's gone out of finance to do an audit and they've had a truly horrible experience because the hotel they've stayed at is dreadful, they feed back to their manager. Does that information make it through to the M&E department who's sending somebody else out to do something, or the program department or the partnership agreement program? What's happening to make sure that this information is not being repeated? And again, an example from my own experience was there was a hotel in Kabul that we used, and it met all of the security requirements, and it did have a really good Lebanese restaurant in it. So people like to stay there. As a woman, particularly when I was traveling on my own, the only channels that the TV had was porn. I mean, there was, I did find CNN, but I think it was channel 327. So you have to go through an awful lot of porn before you found, you know, the news channel or something else. So there were a lot at that time in Kabul, there were a lot of businessmen and people there. So I'd go into the restaurant and I'd look around and I'd think, all of the men in here, and there very rarely would there be another woman, all of these people are doing is sitting in their rooms watching porn. I do not want to be in the middle of that group of people. And I took it off the list of approved hotels for women. I said, okay, men, if you want to go there and watch porn, that's up to you. And I'm sure some men went there and didn't watch porn. But it just made me incredibly uncomfortable. And is that in, and that hotel had been on the acceptable list for ages because it was from a security, from a purely security perspective, it was absolutely fine and it was a good level of security, but didn't make me feel safe.
That's really interesting. I think that, you know, that's a really good example that illuminates when security doesn't always factor in some of these other considerations. And so just kind of following along that same trajectory, do you have reflections about other policies or other guidance that you would have for an organization as they think about the different profiles of their staff and the considerations around these types of examples? Do you have any others that you'd like to share?
I think, yes, we need to consider inclusivity. How do we document it? I mean, I did see some UN policies that they were very proud that they had made all of their policies, the security policies, gender aware, I think was the term. So it just meant that under each section, there was a whole series of bullet points. And the last bullet point was, and consider women, or words to that effect. Now, to me, that was not inclusive. That was an add-on. We've forgotten about the women. Let's have a quick think about them. So it's almost that it's got to be in the heart of the people developing the policies that they need to think about other people's perspectives and recognize that, you know, how they see the world is not how other people see the world. It was one organization I heard of, which I thought was a really interesting idea, was that they got board members to shadow somebody of a personal profile that was very different. So, for example, a black single mother. Now, that's not a profile you see on a board very often. Or getting them to come in and talk to the board and actually say what it's like for them. And you can do this as an exercise, as a tick box, or you can have an open heart and listen to what's being said. And then you have a chance to think about, do my policies recognize the needs of all of these people? And, you know, maybe for now, what we have to think about in our policies is diversity. And maybe that's as far as we can go, is making sure that we are not discriminating against people. Again, to steal some of what one of our colleagues from CBM was saying recently, let's not concentrate on the differences. Let's concentrate on what they can do. Let's not think about what they can't do. Let's concentrate on what they can do. Listen with your ears rather than judging with your eyes.
Wow, that's powerful. I felt that one. Yeah, those are some great words and some really good input there. I do want to just quickly give you a chance to share any takeaways or reflections with us and give you the floor to kind of leave us with any parting words that you might have about this topic.
This has been a really interesting conversation for me because it's gone in areas that I wasn't really expecting. But it's also flagged for me how important this has become and this idea of inclusivity and the fact that it isn't about treating everybody the same. It's about ensuring that everybody has the same opportunities. And in security risk management, we are in a very powerful position, and we need to remember that. You know, what we say and do impacts a huge number of people in the organizations. So if we're going to have a workforce that's effective and fit for purpose and really brings the strength out of the people and enables the projects that we're trying to implement, then we have to make sure that we are inclusive.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you for taking the time to share with us and give us your really insightful words today. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
The Global Interagency Security Forum is a member-led NGO with a global network of over 130 member organizations and affiliates. We are committed to achieving sustainable access for populations in need through improved safety and security for aid workers and operations. GISF's original research, collaboration, and events drive positive change in security risk management across the humanitarian sector. We operate according to the humanitarian principles and lead on best practices and innovation by pushing for a collaborative and inclusive approach to security risk management.